A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one from Jerusalem in July. And honestly, if you've been here this week, you already know the scene. The temperature's pushing 100 degrees Fahrenheit. There's roadwork on what feels like every street. Jackhammers on concrete. Honking that doesn't stop. And somewhere in the middle of it, you catch yourself snapping at someone for no real reason. And you think, is this just me? Or is the anger actually in the air?
That's exactly what he's asking. He's noticed this thing where heat and noise and smog pile up until it feels like the whole city's simmering, and he wants to know whether there's real science behind that, or if it's just a poetic way of describing a bad mood. Specifically, he's wondering which of these stressors hits hardest, whether they combine into something worse than the sum of their parts, and whether the humble air conditioner is doing some kind of unacknowledged social pacification work.
Which is a fantastic framing. The air conditioner as a peacekeeping device. I want that on a plaque.
The deeper question underneath all of it, is the anger in the air just a feeling, or is there real science linking these environmental stressors to our shore fuses? And if the science is solid, what do we actually do with it?
That scene isn't just unpleasant. It's a laboratory for something scientists have been studying for decades. And the short answer, before we even get into mechanisms, is that Daniel's intuition is dead on. The correlations exist, they're measured, and they're stronger than most people realize.
We're going to look at three environmental stressors, heat, noise, and air pollution, and what they do to human behavior. Not just making people grumpy, but measurable increases in aggression, in violence, in the kind of short-tempered irritability that tips over into something worse.
The part that really interests me is what happens when they all hit at once, because they never show up alone. A heat wave brings construction noise and traffic exhaust and everything else. So the question isn't just which one matters most. It's whether there's a combined load, a tipping point where the whole system of stressors pushes a population past some threshold.
That's the combined load hypothesis, and it's where the most interesting research is happening right now. We'll walk through the individual mechanisms first. What heat does to your brain, what noise does to your impulse control, what air pollution does to the parts of your brain that regulate emotion. Then we'll look at how they interact, what the real-world data shows, and what this means for how we design cities.
Somewhere in there, we're going to give the air conditioner its due, because I think Daniel's right. It might be one of the most underappreciated social goods of modern urban life.
Let's start with the most intuitive culprit, heat. But the story is more interesting than you think.
Most people assume heat makes you aggressive because you're uncomfortable. You're sweating, you're sticky, you're miserable, so you lash out. That's the folk explanation. But the actual mechanism is weirder and more specific.
It's called the heat aggression hypothesis, and the key concept is physiological arousal misattribution. When your body gets hot, your heart rate increases, your blood pressure goes up, your cortisol levels spike. Your sympathetic nervous system kicks into a state that looks a lot like the early stages of anger. Your brain notices the elevated arousal and then looks around for something to attribute it to. If the situation is ambiguous, someone bumps into you on the street, a driver cuts you off, your brain goes, well, I'm aroused, this person must have made me angry, and you react accordingly.
It's not that heat makes you angry. It's that heat puts your body into a state that your brain then mislabels as anger when given half an excuse.
The evidence for this is substantial. The landmark paper here is the 2013 meta-analysis by Shong, Burke, and Miguel. They looked at 60 different studies across multiple disciplines, and what they found was striking. For every 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature, interpersonal violence increases by about 2.3%. That's not a rounding error. That's a real, measurable shift in human behavior.
2.3% per degree. So on a day that's 10 degrees Celsius hotter than average, which is not unusual for a heat wave, you're looking at a 23% increase in the baseline rate of interpersonal violence.
That's just the average. The effect is even stronger for certain types of violence. The same analysis found that intergroup conflict, everything from riots to civil wars, increased by about 11 to 14% per standard deviation change in temperature.
Which is a terrifying number when you start projecting forward with climate trends.
But let me give you a cleaner, more controlled example that isolates the mechanism beautifully. There was a 2010 study of Major League Baseball pitchers. The researchers looked at whether pitchers were more likely to hit batters on hotter days, controlling for everything. Game situation, score, the batter's skill, whether the teams had a history. On days above 90 degrees Fahrenheit, the rate of hit batters increased significantly compared to cooler days, even when there was no strategic reason to throw inside.
These are professional athletes, highly trained, in a controlled environment, with every incentive not to hit batters. It puts runners on base, it hurts the team. And still, the heat tipped the balance.
Here's the detail that nails the misattribution mechanism. The effect was almost entirely driven by pitchers who hadn't been provoked. If the other team's pitcher had already hit one of their batters, the retaliation rate was high, regardless of temperature. But the unprovoked hit batters, the ones where there was no obvious trigger, those spiked on hot days. The heat created the arousal, the brain found a target.
The heat isn't creating new grievances. It's lowering the threshold for acting on existing ones, and it's creating false positives when no grievance exists at all. And that distinction matters because it tells you where the intervention points are. You can't eliminate all sources of interpersonal friction, but you might be able to reduce the ambient physiological arousal that turns friction into conflict.
Which brings us to noise. And noise operates through a different pathway entirely. The key variable is predictability and control. A steady, predictable noise, even a loud one, is far less stressful than an unpredictable, uncontrollable one. This is where the jackhammers come in. A jackhammer isn't just loud, it's intermittent, it's jarring, it stops and starts in ways you can't anticipate, and you have no control over it. That combination, unpredictable and uncontrollable, is exactly what triggers the most severe stress response.
There's a concept in psychology called learned helplessness. It comes out of some fairly grim experiments from the 1960s. Dogs exposed to unpredictable, inescapable shocks eventually stopped trying to avoid them, even when escape became possible. The noise equivalent is that when people are exposed to unpredictable, uncontrollable noise over time, they stop trying to regulate their own responses. Their impulse control degrades.
The physiological pathway is cortisol again. Unpredictable noise triggers a cortisol spike, and chronically elevated cortisol impairs the prefrontal cortex. That's the part of your brain responsible for impulse control, emotional regulation, and what psychologists call prosocial behavior. Basically, being nice to other people. There was a 2017 study of London underground workers that found noise levels above 80 decibels correlated with a 30% increase in self-reported anger incidents. These are people whose job is to be in that environment, who presumably adapt to it over time, and still, the effect shows up.
80 decibels is about what you get standing next to a busy road. It's not ear-splitting. It's not a rock concert. It's just... And it's enough to measurably change how people treat each other.
Here's the part that connects back to Daniel's Jerusalem scene. Construction noise, traffic noise, honking. These aren't just loud. They're specifically the kind of unpredictable, uncontrollable noise that maximizes the stress response. A honk comes out of nowhere. A jackhammer pounds for 3 seconds, pauses for two, pounds again. Your brain can't habituate to it the way it can to the steady hum of an air conditioner.
Which is an important distinction we'll come back to. Because the air conditioner is a steady, predictable noise source that actually masks the unpredictable ones.
And that's part of its hidden social value. But before we get there, we need to talk about the third stressor, and this is the one that most people don't think about as a behavioral factor at all.
This is the one that surprised me when I first dug into it, because the idea that bad air makes you cough or gives you asthma, that's intuitive. The idea that it makes you more aggressive, that's a leap. But the mechanism is there, and it's increasingly well documented.
The key is fine particulate matter, PM2.5. These are particles smaller than 2.5 microns across, which means they're small enough to cross from your lungs into your bloodstream, and from there, critically, across the blood-brain barrier. Once they're in the brain, they trigger neuroinflammation, an immune response in the brain tissue itself. and the regions that seem most vulnerable to this inflammation are the prefrontal cortex and the amygdala.
Which are exactly the regions involved in emotion regulation and impulse control. The prefrontal cortex is your brain's brake pedal. The amygdala is the threat detection and emotional reactivity center. Neuroinflammation impairs the prefrontal cortex's ability to inhibit the amygdala, which means you end up with a brain that's more reactive and less regulated. The brake is failing while the accelerator is stuck.
The crime data backs this up. There was a 2019 study out of MIT that looked at 9 years of crime data across the United States and correlated it with daily air pollution levels. They found that a 1 microgram per cubic meter increase in PM2.5 was associated with a 0.5% increase in violent crime. That might sound small, but PM2.5 can easily spike by 10 or 20 micrograms per cubic meter on a bad day. In some cities, day-to-day swings of 50 micrograms aren't unusual, so you're looking at potentially a 25% increase in violent crime on high pollution days compared to clean air days.
The control for everything else? Temperature? Day of the week? Economic factors?
They controlled for temperature, precipitation, day of week, month, year, and county-level economic indicators. The pollution effect persisted independently of all of them. And the effect was strongest for violent crime specifically, assault, domestic violence, rather than property crime. Which is exactly what you'd expect if the mechanism is impaired, emotional regulation rather than, say, economic desperation.
Now we've got three separate pathways. Heat creates physiological arousal that gets misattributed as anger. Noise degrades impulse control through cortisol and learned helplessness. Air pollution physically inflames the brain regions that regulate emotion. Three different mechanisms, all converging on the same outcome. People become more irritable, more reactive, more likely to tip into aggression.
The effect sizes are different. Heat seems to have the largest documented impact on violence. That 2.3% per degree is hard to beat. But noise may have a lower threshold for triggering daily irritability. You don't need a heat wave to get honked at. And air pollution's effect is the most insidious because you can't perceive it directly. You don't know your prefrontal cortex is inflamed, you just find yourself snapping at people and don't know why.
Which raises a question about which one contributes the most to the kind of ambient social anger Daniel's describing. Violence is the extreme tail of the distribution. Most irritability doesn't become violence. It becomes rude comments, aggressive driving, domestic tension, the general sense that everyone's on edge. And I suspect noise might punch above its weight in that part of the distribution.
I think that's right. The London Underground study was measuring anger incidents, not assaults. And noise is the stressor that most directly invades your mental space. Heat you can acclimate to some degree. Pollution you can't see. But noise, especially unpredictable noise, demands your attention in a way the other stressors don't. You can't not hear a jackhammer. There's something uniquely violating about it. Someone else's sound is entering your head without your consent. And I think that has a psychological dimension that goes beyond the cortisol pathway. There's research on noise annoyance as a distinct psychological construct, and one of the strongest predictors isn't the absolute volume, it's whether the noise feels unnecessary or inconsiderate. A loud fan might not bother you. A slightly quieter neighbor's music at 2 in the morning will drive you up the wall. The social meaning of the noise matters.
Which brings us back to honking. Honking is almost never necessary in the way people actually use it. It's an expression of frustration. So you've got one person's frustration being broadcast as noise into the brains of everyone within earshot, raising their cortisol, degrading their impulse control, making them more likely to honk at someone else. It's a feedback loop. The stressor creates the behavior that creates more of the stressor. Jerusalem in July, right there.
Each stressor has its own mechanism. But here's the thing, they never happen alone. And that's where we need to go next, because the combined effect is where this gets genuinely alarming. These stressors don't just coexist, they amplify each other. The combined load hypothesis says that when heat, noise, and air pollution hit simultaneously, the effect isn't additive, it's multiplicative. Your body is already in a heightened arousal state from the heat, your prefrontal cortex is already struggling from the pollution-induced inflammation, and then the noise strips away whatever impulse control you had left. Each one lowers a different barrier.
It's not 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals 3. It's more like each stressor removes a different safety mechanism, and once enough of them are gone, there's nothing left between the impulse and the action.
Think of it as a series of gates. Normally, you have multiple gates between feeling irritated and acting on it. Physiological regulation, cognitive reappraisal, impulse control. Heat opens the first gate by creating arousal that feels like anger. Pollution opens the second gate by impairing the brain regions that would normally override that feeling. Noise opens the third gate by depleting the mental energy required for self-regulation. When all three gates are open, the pathway from irritation to aggression is essentially unobstructed.
The real-world data is starting to capture this. A 2021 study from the University of Chicago looked at days with both high heat and high ozone. They found 15% more violent crime on those days compared to days with high heat alone. The ozone wasn't just adding a little extra irritation on top. It was changing what the heat did to people.
That's the amplification effect in action. And ozone is just one component of air pollution. When you add in PM2.5 and noise, the combined load gets even heavier. The problem is that most research still studies these stressors in isolation. You'll find 100 papers on heat and aggression, and 50 on noise and cognition, and maybe a dozen on air pollution and behavior. But studies that track all three simultaneously in real-world settings? Those are rare. And that's the data we actually need for urban planning.
Because cities don't dose you with one stressor at a time. A summer day in Jerusalem hits you with all three before you've even left your apartment. And Daniel's question about whether there's a recognized threshold, a combined load above which you see a noticeable spike, that's exactly what researchers are trying to quantify now. We don't have a clean number yet, but the shape of the curve is becoming clear. It's not linear, it's a hockey stick. Below a certain combined load, people cope. Above it, coping fails rapidly.
That has enormous implications for how we think about public health and urban design. Right now, most cities regulate these things separately. There's a noise ordinance. There's an air quality standard. There's maybe a heat advisory. But nobody is measuring the combined environmental stress load and treating it as a single, integrated risk factor. And if the amplification effect is real, and the evidence says it is, then regulating them in silos is missing the point entirely.
This is what we're going to spend the rest of the episode unpacking. How these interactions play out in actual cities, what the inequality dimension looks like, because of course the same heat wave hits different neighborhoods differently, and what policy responses are actually working in places that have started taking this seriously.
Yes, we will get to the air conditioner's hidden role as a 3-in-1 intervention. It cools, it masks noise, and it filters air. It's accidentally the perfect device for reducing combined environmental stress load. Daniel was onto something. Let's talk about the air conditioner because Daniel's instinct here is sharp. The standard way we think about AC is as a comfort device. It keeps you cool, it helps you sleep, it makes summer bearable. But when you look at it through the lens of combined environmental stress load, the air conditioner is doing three things simultaneously. It's lowering ambient temperature, which reduces that physiological arousal misattribution pathway. It's creating a sealed environment that filters out a meaningful fraction of PM2.5. Most modern units have filters that catch particles down to the 10 micron range. Some go finer. And it's generating steady, predictable white noise that masks the unpredictable noise outside.
It's a 3-in-1 stress reducer, and nobody designed it for that. It's an accident. Willis Carrier was trying to control humidity for a printing press in 1902, not prevent bar fights.
The data on this is striking. A 2018 study looked at the relationship between heat and violent crime across U.S. cities and found that access to air conditioning reduced the heat crime correlation by 60%. That's not a marginal tweak. That's the difference between a heat wave being dangerous and being merely unpleasant.
That's just the heat pathway. If you layer in the noise masking and the air filtration, the total effect is probably larger than what that study captured, because it was only looking at temperature as the variable. Which means the humble air conditioner might be one of the most effective violence prevention devices ever deployed at scale, and we'd never really given it credit for that. We think of it as a luxury or a convenience. It's a public health intervention.
That reframing matters enormously for policy, because it changes how you think about access. If AC is a comfort item, it's fine for the market to distribute it however the market does. If it's a violence prevention tool and a public health measure, then who has it and who doesn't becomes a question of equity and safety, not just comfort.
Which brings us directly to the inequality dimension. Because the neighborhoods that need AC the most are the ones least likely to have it.
This is where the knock-on effect gets brutal. Low-income neighborhoods systematically have less tree cover and less green space, which means they're measurably hotter during heat waves, sometimes by 5 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit compared to tree-lined affluent neighborhoods in the same city. They have older buildings with worse insulation, so even if they have AC, it's less effective and more expensive to run. They're more likely to be near major roads, industrial zones, or other sources of both noise and air pollution. And they have fewer resources for coping. Less disposable income for air purifiers, noise-canceling headphones, or even just taking a day off when the combined load is unbearable.
The same heat wave hits different zip codes at different intensities. The baseline environmental stress load is already higher before the heat wave even starts. And then, when temperatures spike, those neighborhoods cross the threshold faster and stay above it longer.
You get a feedback loop. Higher stress load reduces coping capacity. Reduced coping capacity makes people more reactive to additional stressors. More reactivity creates more interpersonal conflict, which itself becomes a stressor. The environment isn't just causing the problem, it's eroding the resources people would normally use to deal with the problem.
The 1995 Chicago heat wave is the canonical example here. Over 700 people died, but the mortality rate wasn't evenly distributed. Neighborhoods with high AC penetration saw roughly 80% fewer heat-related deaths. And the anecdotal reports from that week, police and social workers described a noticeable drop in domestic disturbance calls from the cooled neighborhoods and a spike in the ones that weren't. Same city, same heat wave. Radically different outcomes based on who had access to a machine that nobody was thinking of as a safety device.
That was 30 years ago. The disparity hasn't gone away. In a lot of American cities, the tree canopy gap between wealthy and poor neighborhoods has actually widened. The urban heat island effect is getting more intense as cities densify. And climate change is making heat waves more frequent, longer, and more severe. So the combined environmental stress load is rising, and it's rising fastest for the people least equipped to handle it.
What does an intelligent policy response look like? Because we can't just hand out air conditioners and call it a day. The electricity to run them has to come from somewhere, and if it's coming from fossil fuels, you're contributing to the air pollution side of the equation. You're solving one stressor by feeding another.
That's exactly the tension. And it's why the most interesting urban interventions are the ones that address multiple stressors simultaneously without creating new ones. Barcelona's Superblock program is the best example I've seen. The idea is to take a 3x3 grid of city blocks and restrict through traffic to the perimeter. Inside the superblock, streets become pedestrian priority, speeds drop to about 6 miles per hour, and the space gets reclaimed for trees, benches, playgrounds. It's not just a traffic intervention, it's a combined stress load intervention.
They measured the results.
In the pilot areas, nitrogen dioxide dropped by 25%. Noise levels dropped by 5 decibels, which doesn't sound like much, but decibels are logarithmic, so 5 decibels is roughly a 2/3 reduction in perceived loudness. And they recorded a 10% drop in reported public altercations. 10% just from redesigning a few blocks.
They reduced air pollution, reduced noise, and added green space that reduces ambient temperature, all with one intervention. That's what a combined load approach looks like in practice. You're not trying to solve heat and then noise and then pollution as separate problems. You're redesigning the urban environment to reduce all three at once.
Singapore has been doing a version of this for decades, but more through building codes than street redesign. Mandatory green roofs and vertical gardens on new buildings. Noise buffer zones between residential areas and major roads. Trees integrated into the design of public housing estates, not as an afterthought. They treat greenery as infrastructure, not decoration. And the effect is that even in a dense tropical city, the ambient stress load is lower than it would otherwise be.
The phrase environmental stress budget is starting to show up in urban planning literature. The idea is that, just like a building has a structural load limit, a neighborhood has a combined environmental stress capacity. You can't just keep adding heat and noise and pollution and expect the social fabric to hold. At some point, you've exceeded the budget, and the cost shows up in hospital admissions, police calls, domestic violence reports, traffic accidents.
Right now, almost no city is measuring this. They measure air quality to meet EPA standards. They measure noise to enforce ordinances. They issue heat advisories when the temperature crosses some threshold. But nobody is combining those numbers into a single index and saying, okay, today the environmental stress load in this neighborhood is at 87% of capacity. We should probably activate cooling centers and delay non-emergency road work.
Which is exactly the kind of thing Daniel was gesturing toward. Is there a recognized combined load above which you see a noticeable spike? The honest answer is that we don't have a standardized metric yet, but the research is pointing in that direction. And the cities that get there first are going to have a significant advantage in managing everything from public health to public safety. What do we actually do with this knowledge? Let's get practical, because I think there are three different audiences here, and they each need a different version of the answer.
Start with the individual. If you're listening to this in a hot apartment with the windows open and jackhammers outside, what can you actually do? First thing is to take the mechanism seriously. The irritation you're feeling isn't a character flaw. It's your nervous system responding to real physiological triggers. That alone is useful. Naming it reduces the misattribution effect. If you know your heart is racing because of the heat, you're less likely to decide it's because your spouse is being infuriating.
Which is basically cognitive behavioral therapy for environmental stress. Name the arousal. Attribute it correctly. Short-circuit the anger cascade before it finds a target.
Beyond that, the interventions are surprisingly straightforward. Noise-canceling headphones aren't just a gadget. They're a cortisol management tool. Even basic foam earplugs can take the edge off unpredictable noise enough to preserve some impulse control. A decent air purifier with a HEPA filter can pull a meaningful amount of PM2.5 out of your indoor air. Not all of it, but enough to reduce the neural inflammatory load. And hydration is important here, because dehydration amplifies the physiological arousal effects of heat. Your heart rate goes up, your body works harder to cool itself, and all of that feeds back into the arousal misattribution pathway.
The personal toolkit is, reduce the noise, clean the air, stay hydrated, and know that what you're feeling is biology, not destiny. None of that solves the problem, but it raises your threshold. It buys you margin.
Margin is everything when you're near the tipping point. Now for policymakers. This is where the air conditioner reframing becomes actionable. If AC reduces the heat crime correlation by 60%, then access to cooling isn't a luxury good. It's a public safety intervention on par with street lighting. Subsidizing air conditioning for low-income households or providing portable units during heat waves or requiring cooling centers in every neighborhood. These aren't comfort measures. They're violence prevention.
The green infrastructure piece is even better, because it's a one-to-many solution. A single mature tree cools the air through shade and evapotranspiration, absorbs sound, and filters particulate matter. It's a three-in-one stress reducer that doesn't require electricity and doesn't create emissions. Planting trees in the neighborhoods that have the least canopy isn't beautification. It's a combined environmental load intervention.
Barcelona's superblocks, Singapore's green roofs, tree planting programs targeted at low canopy neighborhoods, these are the models, and they pay for themselves. The avoided healthcare costs, the avoided policing costs, the productivity gains from a population that isn't constantly at the edge of its stress capacity, the return on investment is real and measurable.
Which leads to the third audience, urban planners. And the concrete recommendation here is to stop regulating these things in separate silos. Right now, a new development might need to meet a noise standard, an air quality assessment, and maybe a heat island mitigation requirement. But they're evaluated independently, and nobody's adding them up. A building could be right at the limit on all three and get approved, even though the combined load on residents would be significantly above any reasonable threshold.
The fix is a combined environmental load metric. Instead of three separate pass-fail tests, you have one integrated score that accounts for the amplification effects. If your site has high ambient noise and poor air quality, you get a tighter heat mitigation requirement. If you're in a quiet area with clean air, you get more flexibility on temperature. The point is to manage the total load, not the individual components.
This isn't theoretical. The Barcelona Superblock data shows that when you reduce noise and pollution and heat simultaneously, you get a drop in public altercations that's larger than what you'd predict from any single factor. The combined metric isn't just intellectually satisfying. It captures something real about how human beings actually experience their environment. We don't live in silos. Our stress responses don't either. The open question that keeps me up, and I mean that almost literally, I'm a sloth, I value my sleep, is what happens as the baseline rises. Climate models are projecting more frequent and more intense heat waves. Urbanization is concentrating more people in exactly the environments where noise and pollution are hardest to escape. So the combined environmental stress load isn't just high right now, it's trending upward. And it's trending upward fastest in the places with the most people.
We don't have a good model for what that does to a society over decades. The studies we've been citing are mostly snapshots. This heat wave, that pollution spike, this noisy year. But if the baseline keeps rising, we're not just looking at more spikes. We're looking at a population whose chronic stress load is higher all the time, whose coping reserves are perpetually depleted, whose thresholds for aggression are permanently lowered. That's not a bad summer. That's a structural change in how people relate to each other.
Which means we need a new kind of research collaboration. Criminologists understand the violence data, but typically don't model environmental variables beyond maybe temperature. Climatologists can project heat waves and pollution trends, but aren't trained to translate those into behavioral outcomes. Neuroscientists understand the mechanisms. The amygdala, the prefrontal cortex, the cortisol pathways. But they're working at the individual level, not the population level. Nobody is sitting at the intersection of all three, and building the integrated models we need to forecast this.
Environmental anger forecasts. That's the thing we don't have yet. We have air quality alerts and heat advisories and thunderstorm warnings. We don't have a forecast that says tomorrow's combined stress load in this neighborhood will be in the 95th percentile. Expect elevated irritability, consider activating cooling centers, and maybe reschedule that contentious public meeting.
The data exists to build it. We have real-time air quality monitoring, real-time temperature data, noise mapping in a lot of cities now. The crime and hospital data is available with timestamps in locations. The machine learning tools to correlate all of it and produce a predictive model. That's not science fiction. It's an integration problem, not an invention problem.
The barrier is institutional. The people who collect the environmental data don't talk to the people who collect the behavioral data. The funding mechanisms aren't set up for this kind of cross-disciplinary work. And there's a weird political reluctance to acknowledge that the physical environment shapes behavior in ways people don't consciously control, because it feels like it diminishes personal responsibility.
Which is a category error. Understanding that your brain is being influenced by PM2.5 doesn't absolve you of responsibility for your actions. It gives you better tools for managing them. And at the societal level, it gives us better tools for designing environments that don't set people up to fail.
The closing thought I want to leave people with is this. The next time you find yourself inexplicably furious on a hot, noisy, smoggy day, and you will because it's July and we live in cities, that anger isn't just in your head, it's in the air. It's in the particles crossing from your lungs into your bloodstream and from your bloodstream into your brain. It's in the cortisol your adrenal glands released the 17th time someone leaned on their horn. It's in the elevated heart rate your body is misreading as emotional arousal. You're not crazy, and you're not a bad person. You're a nervous system responding exactly the way nervous systems respond to a specific set of inputs.
Knowing that is the first step toward doing something about it, whether that's putting on noise, canceling headphones, planting a tree, or rethinking how we build the places we live.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1980s, resistance fighters in Madagascar built radio receivers out of razor blades and pencil graphite. A single blood steel razor blade, when lightly oxidized by flame, formed a semiconductor junction capable of detecting AM radio signals without any external power source. Modern spectrum analyzers put the sensitivity of these improvised detectors at roughly -25 dBm, which is comparable to a first-generation crystal radio kit you'd buy today for $12.
Right? This has been my Weird Prompts. Thank you to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, tell someone who's currently stuck in traffic with their windows down. We're at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Stay cool out there.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.